Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. Today, we're diving into an investigation of a really powerful and sophisticated state, the Sasanian Empire. It dominated Iran and the Near East for, over 400 years, from 224 to 601 CE?
That's right. A major player for a very long time.
And you've shared this great collection of articles and research notes. These are going to be our guide today. Our mission, really, is to go through this material together, pull out the most important insights, maybe some surprising facts too, just to give you a clear, solid picture of this whole period, you know, without getting totally bogged down in every single detail.
Think of it like getting a good grounding in Sasanian history using the information you've gathered. And it's important to see how they were different from the Parthians who came before them. The Sasanians, they were aiming for something else.
Different how?
Well, they pushed for a more centralized state, much more driven by ideology, by religion, and they really set themselves up as a major world power. A serious rival to Rome, and then later, Byzantium.
Okay, so let's start right at the beginning then. The dawn of this new Persian Empire. The sources you shared really emphasize the decline of the Parthians as the key starting point. What exactly was happening there? What set the stage?
Well, the material points pretty clearly to significant internal issues within the Parthian Arsacid dynasty. Their central government was relatively weak. Structurally, it was more of a feudal setup.
Feudal, meaning powerful local lords.
Exactly. Lots of autonomy for powerful regional families. This kind of structure, it often led to instability, civil wars even. Rulers had to grant power just to keep loyalty, which, you know, ended up fragmenting the state. These local magnates were practically running their own shows.
Right. So the system itself had inherent weaknesses.
It did. Resilient for a long time, yes, but prone to fracturing. And then you add the external pressures on top of that, especially from Rome.
The Roman Wars.
Constant pressure, frequent, really devastating invasions and raids. The Romans sacked the Parthian capital, Ctesiphon, multiple times. The sources mention Septimius Severus's campaign as being particularly damaging.
Damaging how? Militarily or?
Both militarily and psychologically. Losing your capital city repeatedly, it really undermines the dynasty's prestige, its authority, and that contributed to internal revolts. It wasn't an instant collapse, but these wars just drained their resources year after year.
I think the notes mentioned economic problems too. Pestilence.
Yes, absolutely. Things like a major plague, likely linked to those Roman wars, worsened the situation. It contributed to the fragmentation, the lawlessness described in the early 3rd century CE. The picture the sources paint is one of local areas suffering, lacking central control under economic strain.
So a power vacuum was forming.
Pretty much, and a real need for more effective leadership. Which brings us right to Ardashir I.
Right, the architect of the Sasanian state. What does the sources tell us about him, his background?
He came from Persis, which was seen as the traditional heartland, religiously significant. His family claimed descent from a figure named Sasan, possibly a Zoroastrian priest. That link gave him a kind of religious legitimacy right from the start.
And his father was already a local power.
Yes, Papak. He'd overthrown the local ruler in Istakh, the main city there. Ardashir built on that foundation. He systematically expanded his control, cleverly exploiting the weaknesses in the Parthian system we just talked about.
So it wasn't just a sudden rebellion, it was a calculated rise.
Very much so. The sources show he acted like a sovereign ruler quite early on, minting his own coins, founding new cities. These are clear declarations of intent.
And the decisive moment.
That was the Battle of Hormuzgan in 224 CE. Ardashir met the Parthian king, Artabanus IV, defeated him, killed him. And just like that, nearly 5 centuries of Parthian rule were over. Soon after, he was crowned Shahanshah, King of Kings, in Ctesiphon. That marks the official start of the Sasanian dynasty. But crucially, his claim wasn't just based on military victory. It was heavily ideological.
Okay, and this is where Zoroastrianism becomes really central.
Absolutely fundamental. The sources really stress the strong alliance with the Zoroastrian priesthood. Figures like the high priest Tansar were key allies. Zoroastrianism wasn't just favored, it was elevated, made into the state religion.
The idea that religion and kingship were brothers.
Exactly. That's a core Sasanian concept. They needed each other, reinforced each other. Ardashir also claimed divine backing, styling himself as being descended from the gods.
A divine mandate and a state religion. Powerful combination.
And there's more. He deliberately connected his new empire back to the glories of the ancient Achaemenids, Cyrus, Darius, that era.
A conscious revival.
Oh, yes. It wasn't just nostalgia. It was a political statement. They were restoring past greatness, forging a stronger sense of Iranian identity. They even popularized the term Iran, or Aranshar, for their realm. And this historical claim, it was also a message to Rome. Persia is back. And it's assertive.
Okay, so Ardashir sets the stage. And this dynasty then rules for, as you said, over 400 years. That seems stable, but the sources hint succession wasn't always straightforward.
That's a really important nuance. The dynasty itself was long-lasting, yes.
Great.
But the transfer of power, often messy. You had these incredibly powerful noble families, military commanders. They could challenge a ruler they saw as weak or exploit a crisis.
Any examples jump out from the notes?
Well, there are cases like Bahram III being overthrown by Narsa, or Kavada being temporarily replaced by Zamasp. And the period after Khosrow II's death is extreme, something like 10 rulers in just 4 or 5 years. It shows that underlying instability, how the throne could become a prize fought over by factions.
Let's touch on a couple of the really famous Shahanshahs mentioned. Shapurvirst.
Ah, Shapurvirst. Probably most famous for capturing the Roman Emperor Valerian in 260 CE near Edessa.
Wow, capturing an emperor.
Huge propaganda coup, immortalized in those Sasanian rock reliefs, a massive blow to Roman prestige. Shapur also expanded the empire significantly and was the first to use that grand title, King of Kings of Iranians and Non-Iranians. It showed his ambition wasn't just regional.
And then there's Khosrow I, often called Anushirvan. He seems to stand out too.
He does. Khosrow, ruling in the 6th century, is generally seen as a high point, a sort of golden age figure. The sources credit him with major administrative and military reforms that really strengthened the empire during his long reign. We'll definitely talk more about those reforms. His era is linked with major cultural achievements as well.
And the notes mentioned something quite surprising for the time. Women rulers.
Yes, quite unusual for a patriarchal society like Sasanian Persia. During that chaotic time after Khosrow II died, two women, Boren and Azarmadok, actually ruled briefly as queens.
Really? How did that happen?
The sources suggest it points to just how deep the political crisis was. The ruling elite were desperate to maintain legitimacy through the Sasanian bloodline. When viable male heirs ran out or were killed off in the infighting, they turned to female members of the house. It's a fascinating glimpse of tradition bending under extreme pressure.
Okay, turning to the military and the wider geopolitical scene, this seems absolutely central to the Sasanian story, constant conflict almost.
They were definitely a dynamic, often aggressive power. We mentioned Shapurai capturing Valerian, but he also did something else interesting. He deported skilled Roman citizens, artisans, engineers, and resettled them within the empire.
Why do that?
To use their skills for building infrastructure, new cities like Gundishapur. It shows a very pragmatic approach, leveraging conquered populations for state benefit.
And the sources consistently talk about this long tug of war with Rome and later Byzantium.
That rivalry, primarily fought over Mesopotamia, Armenia, and the Caucasus, really defines centuries of Sasanian foreign policy. But what's quite striking when you look at the maps and the source material is that despite this near-constant warfare...
The border didn't actually shift all that much for a long period.
Exactly. It wasn't for lack of trying on either side. It speaks to the resilience of both empires, the immense logistical challenges of campaigning in that region, and the sheer cost. The wars were attritional. They spurred military innovation, sure, but rarely led to decisive, lasting knockout blows.
So lots of treaties and truces mentioned.
Oh, frequently. But they were almost always opportunistic, transactional, driven by immediate strategic needs, maybe trouble on another border or internal issues, not usually about finding a genuine, lasting peace.
But Rome wasn't the only major rival, right? The notes mention threats from the east.
Correct. The Hephthalate Huns, emerging from Central Asia in the 5th century, posed a very serious threat on their northeastern frontier.
How serious?
Extremely. The Sasanian Emperor Peroz was defeated and killed fighting them near Balkh in 484 CE. A catastrophe. It forced the Sasanians to pay humiliating tribute. They lost key eastern cities for a time. It was a massive blow to their prestige and drained resources.
And just like the Romans, the Hephthalites sometimes got involved in Sasanian internal politics.
They did. The sources mention they actually helped Kavadhai regain his throne after he'd been deposed by the nobility. It shows that same vulnerability, external powers exploiting internal divisions. It happened on both frontiers.
So how did the Sasanians eventually manage the Hephthalite problem?
That brings us back to Khosrow first. He showed real strategic thinking. He forged an alliance with another rising power in Central Asia, the Western Turks. Together, they decisively crushed the Hephthalites around 560 CE. It restored Sasanian control in the east and demonstrated pretty sophisticated diplomacy, playing one rival off against another.
Let's zoom in on the Sasanian military itself then, the SPA. What made it so effective for so long?
Well, a key development, building on the Parthians, was a more organized standing army with some form of mandatory service. But again, Khosrow's reforms seem critical here.
What did he change specifically?
He did away with the single, potentially overmighty supreme commander, the Iran Spahbed. Instead, he created four regional commanders, Spahbeds, one for each quarter of the empire. This likely improved regional defense, but also gave the king more central control, preventing one general from becoming too powerful. He also further professionalized the army's state-provided equipment.
And the heart of this army was the cavalry. The sources talk a lot about the Savarin.
Absolutely. The elite Savarin, sometimes called Uzwaran, they were the backbone. These were nobles, highly trained, heavily armored professionals.
Oh, heavily armored how?
Think mail, maybe some plate armor, even armor for their horses' cataphracts. Their main weapon for the charge was a long lance, the nozak. Stirrups likely helped enhance the impact of these charges, but they weren't just lancers. They were also skilled with swords, maces, bows, kind of a versatile heavy cavalryman. Some elite units even had names like the Immortals, harking back to the Achaemenids.
So these were the real core fighting force.
Definitely the elite shock element. There are other troops, of course, lighter cavalry, often allies or mercenaries, infantry, mostly archers and peasant levies in supporting roles, even war elephants. But the Savarin were key.
And another crucial difference from the Parthians mentioned in the notes, siege warfare.
Yes, this was a major Sasanian strength. Unlike the Parthians, who were more focused on mobile cavalry tactics, the Sasanians developed really sophisticated siege capabilities on par with the Romans. They used siege engines, ballistae, catapults built towers, dug mines, even diverted rivers. This ability to take fortified cities was essential for their campaigns in Roman territory.
But not invincible. The sources hint at weaknesses that maybe played a role later on.
Right. While incredibly effective against traditional heavy armies like the Byzantines, the sources suggest this powerful but perhaps less flexible heavy cavalry force struggled against the very different tactics of the early Arab armies in the 7th century, their speed, mobility, fighting in broken terrain. That mismatch in tactics seems to have been a contributing factor in the final defeats.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Roj Bosch, Hannah.
Ah, wonderful timing. A welcome pause.
This chai smells absolutely incredible today.
Hmm. Tasting it.
Oh.
Mm, perfect. It's just right. Not bitter at all today. Maybe last time it needed a touch more sugar, but this, spot on.
It really is good. A nice warmth for the throat, too.
Yeah.
Good moment for it. Definitely. All right. Refreshed by that excellent chai, let's get back to our investigation. We've talked military might. Now let's shift focus to Sasanian society, the economy, daily life.
Yeah.
The sources paint a picture of a complex but also quite rigid structure.
Yes, it was certainly diverse, lots of different groups within the empire, but it was organized along pretty strict hierarchical lines, and this structure was heavily influenced, even reinforced, by the state-backed Zoroastrian religion.
The sources often mention four main classes, right?
That's a common description. At the very top, you had the priests, the Mobadan, wielding immense religious and often legal power. Then the warriors, the Artushtaran, which included the high nobility and those Savarin cavalrymen. Below them, the scribes and bureaucrats, the Abaran, essential for running the state, and then the vast majority of the commoners, farmers, artisans, merchants, the Masastarishan and Hutakshan.
And it was hard to move between these classes, almost like a caste system.
The sources suggest social mobility was very difficult, yes. It wasn't maybe quite as rigid as the Indian caste system,
right.
But the principle was similar. Maintain social order through inherited status. And there was a huge gulf in lifestyle rights, and especially burdens like taxes between the elite and the commoners, particularly the peasantry.
Tell us a bit more about the nobility. It wasn't just one monolithic group.
No, you had the great, powerful families, the Wuzurgan, who often held vast estates and influence, sometimes challenging the king himself. Then there was a lower tier of nobility, the Azedan, who formed the core of the Savarin cavalry. This tension between the monarchy and the powerful magnates is a recurring theme in the sources.
And wasn't there another group, the Dequans?
Yes, that's an interesting development, particularly associated with Khosrowhag's reforms. These were essentially local landowners, maybe gentry is a rough equivalent. They became really important local administrators and tax collectors. Some historians think the crown deliberately promoted this class to create a loyal base in the provinces, kind of counterbalancing the power of the old great families.
Okay, so what was life actually like for people in the cities versus the countryside?
Well, the cities, Ctesiphon, Gundishapur, Bishapur, many others were hubs, centers of administration, commerce, crafts. The sources mention organized bazaars with guilds for different trades supervised by an official. Merchants, especially those dealing in high-value goods like silk, could be quite influential. And interestingly, the sources note that artisans were generally legally free individuals, not serfs. But the empire's foundation, the absolute majority of the population, lived and worked in the countryside. Agriculture was king.
Highly valued in Zoroastrianism too, right? Cultivation.
Yes, there was an ideological emphasis on agriculture. Wheat, barley, rice, fruits, cotton were key crops. But the real key to agriculture in much of the region was water management. The Sasanians were masters of this.
How's it?
Sophisticated irrigation, canals, dams, bridges, and especially qanats, those incredible underground aqueducts that tap into groundwater. You can still see the remains of some Sasanian waterworks today, like at Shishtar. The sources even mention Roman prisoners of war being used on some of these massive engineering projects. They were skilled
But
builders,
life for the average peasant farmer.
likely very tough. They were the main source of tax revenue, originally a portion of the harvest, later Khosrow tax. I introduced a more predictable but possibly heavier fixed land tax plus a poll tax. Their lives were tied to the land, mobility was limited, diet was basic compared to the elites. Trade, though, was extensive. Sasanian merchants were active on the Silk Road, and maritime routes via the Persian Gulf reached India, East Asia, even Africa. They traded silks, textiles, pearls, glassware.
The sources also discuss the status of women, which sounds complicated.
It definitely was. It was a patriarchal society, no doubt, shaped by Zoroastrian traditions where women were generally under male authority, father or husband. But, and this is important, the sources indicate Sasanian women had significant legal rights, which is maybe surprising.
So what kind of rights?
They could own property independently, they could enter into contracts, engage in business, they were legally responsible for their own debts or violations. That's a notable degree of legal personhood for the time.
And marriage. The notes mention different types.
Yes, marriage was highly valued. A father had a duty to arrange a marriage for his daughter, but the sources describe several forms. The most common, the privileged marriage, padiksha, gave the wife full rights, equal inheritance with sons, and authority within the household. But there were other forms, like a subordinate marriage or concubinage, chagar, with fewer rights, and even a form where a woman could choose her own husband under certain circumstances, quadri, though with potential inheritance implications.
So not monolithic.
Not at all. Divorce was possible, though generally easier for the husband. Polygamy was practiced, mainly by the wealthy elite. There's also mention of a controversial practice of next of kin marriage, quota, which is debated by scholars. And as we saw earlier, in extreme circumstances, royal women could even rule.
Okay, let's shift from the social structure to culture and intellect. The sources really portray the Sasanian era as a time of major flourishing.
It absolutely was a kind of renaissance building on older Iranian traditions, but also actively engaging with and absorbing influences from Greece, Rome, India, and the Syriac world. In art and architecture, think big. Monumental palaces like Taki Kisra in Ctesiphon, with its enormous vaulted arch, pure imperial statement, decorated lavishly with stucco, mosaics depicting court life, hunts, music.
Now, those rock reliefs we mentioned earlier.
Unique and powerful, carved directly into cliffs, mostly in the Fars region. They're like imperial billboards, commemorating the king's investiture by the gods, military victories, royal hunts symbolizing prowess. Naqsh-e Rustam, Bishapur key sites. They give us invaluable visual details about crowns, clothing, royal ideology. They were also brilliant metalworkers, exquisite silver and gold plates, bowls, ewers. Often decorated with royal hunting scenes, these were prestige items, sometimes sent as diplomatic gifts. The king's specific crown often identifies their ruler. Their luxury textiles, especially silks with distinct motifs like confronting animals or birds in roundels, were famous across the known world, found as far away as China and Europe. And their glasswork was high quality too. Sasanian art had a huge influence, lasting well into the Islamic period and beyond.
What about scholarship and learning? This seems like another major contribution.
Huge. The Sasanian state, especially under rulers like Khosrow Safish, actively encouraged learning and translation. The most famous center, of course, was the Academy of Gundishapur.
What was special about Gundishapur?
It became this incredibly cosmopolitan hub. Scholars from different backgrounds, Persian Zoroastrians, Syriac Christians, Greeks, Indians came together. It was particularly renowned for medicine, but also philosophy and other sciences. Khosrow, I famously invited Neoplatonist philosophers expelled from Athens and brought scholars and texts from India.
So a real melting pot of knowledge.
Exactly. And they weren't just collecting knowledge, they were translating it. There was a massive effort to translate important works from Greek, Syriac, and Sanskrit into Pahlavi, the Middle Persian language of the empire. Medicine, astronomy, philosophy, even Indian fables like the Panchatantra translated by the physician Borzui.
And Gundishapur's medical school? Was it influential?
Very much so. It's considered one of the most important medical centers of the ancient world. Some sources describe it as perhaps the first true teaching hospital, where students learned theory but also worked directly with patients under supervision. Graduates apparently had to pass exams. It combined Greek, Indian, and Persian medical traditions.
What was the long-term impact of all this intellectual activity?
Immense. After the Arab conquest, many of these scholars, or their students, moved to Baghdad, the new capital of the Islamic Caliphate. They brought their knowledge and, crucially, those Pahlavi translations with them. This formed a vital foundation for the great translation movement in the early Islamic world, where these texts were then translated into Arabic, preserving vast amounts of ancient Greek, Persian, and Indian knowledge, and eventually transmitting it back to Europe during the Renaissance. The Sasanians were a crucial bridge.
And the language itself? Pahlavi? What kind of literature survives?
Pahlavi, or Middle Persian, was the official administrative and religious language. A significant body of literature was written or compiled in it, mostly religious texts, the codification of the Zoroastrian Avesta and its commentaries, the Zand, plus important theological works like the Bundahishan, but also legal texts, wisdom literature, and even historical romances like the story of Ardashir the First's Rise.
And this connects to the later Persian epics.
Yes, crucially. The Sasanian era played a vital role in preserving the ancient Iranian epic traditions. Court chronicles, oral stories about kings and heroes, these were collected, perhaps in works like the Qadaynameh, Book of Lords. This Sasanian material became the primary source for Ferdowsi when he composed the Shahnameh, the great Persian national epic, centuries later. They were custodians of that historical and legendary memory.
So they preserved the past for the future?
In many ways, yes. The Pahlavi literary tradition bridged ancient Iran and the Islamic Iranian world, profoundly influencing later Persian literature and identity. Of course, other languages like Syriac, Greek, and Aramaic were also used within the diverse empire. In science and technology, beyond medicine, they excelled in practical engineering those water systems, military tech. They also developed astronomical tables, the Zizi Shariyan.
And music. The sources mentioned it was important, too.
Very important, especially at court. Royal banquets, ceremonies, music was integral. Rulers like Khosrow II were famous patrons. The legendary musician Barbad is credited with systematizing Persian music, creating modes and melodies perhaps linked to the calendar. Names like Bamshad and Nakisa are also remembered. This Sasanian musical tradition is seen as the root of later Persian classical music, the Daska system.
Okay, let's dig a bit deeper into the religious landscape. We know Zoroastrianism was the state religion, but the sources show it was much more complex than that.
Absolutely. Zoroastrianism was undeniably central, allied with the throne. You had the core beliefs, the dualism of Ahura Mazda, good versus Ahriman, evil, the importance of righteousness, Adash, fire temples with sacred fires, and a powerful priesthood led by the Mobadan Mobed, who oversaw rituals, law, education. Figures like Tansar helped codify the religion, while others, like the priest Kartir in the early Sasanian period, actively worked to promote a specific orthodoxy and suppress other religions.
So there were internal debates and efforts to define the faith.
Yes, the codification of the Avesta and its Pahlavi commentaries, the Zand, was part of this. There were also theological developments and debates, like Zervanism, a variant that posited time, Zervan, as the ultimate origin of both good and evil, though its prevalence is debated by scholars. And the relationship between kings and priests wasn't always smooth. Yazdegerd, I got the nickname the Sinner, partly for his tolerance towards minorities, which angered some Orthodox clergy.
And what about other faiths within the empire? Manichaeism started there, didn't it?
It did. Mani was a subject of the Sasanian Empire, born in Babylonia. His religion was a radical new synthesis, a dualism of light and darkness locked in eternal cosmic struggle, with asceticism and secret knowledge, gnosis, as the path to liberation. It incorporated elements from Zoroastrianism, Christianity, and Buddhism.
How did the Sasanian state react to it?
Initially, under Shapur I, Mani found some tolerance, even favor. He dedicated a book to Shapur, but this didn't last. Under later kings, influenced by the Zoroastrian establishment, led by figures like Kartir, Manichaeism faced intense persecution. Mani himself died in prison or was executed. Despite this, Manichaeism proved remarkably resilient and spread widely, east into Central Asia and China, and west into the Roman Empire.
Christianity was also a major presence.
A very significant one, especially in the western provinces like Mesopotamia. The majority belonged to the Church of the East, often called Nestorian by outsiders, and primarily spoke Syriac.
What was their relationship with the Sasanian state like?
It fluctuated, often tied to relations with the Roman Byzantine Empire. Since Byzantium was Christian, Sasanian Christians were sometimes suspected of disloyalty, especially during wars. This led to periods of persecution, notably under Shapur II in the 4th century and again in the early 5th century. These were often instigated or encouraged by zealous Zoroastrian priests.
But they survived and organized.
Yes. Partly due to these pressures, and also doctrinal reasons, the Church of the East formally organized itself as autonomous from churches in the Roman Empire, with its own head, the Catholicos, or Patriarch, based near the capital Ctesiphon. They held synods to define their structure and theology. In Armenia, after conflict, the Treaty of Inversac eventually granted religious freedom. And in later periods, some rulers, like Khosrow II, even showed favor to Christians. Many ancient churches still stand in former Sasanian lands, and Christian scholars were very active in translation.
And the Jewish communities. Sources mention the Talmudic era.
Indeed. Babylonia, largely under Sasanian rule, was the heartland of rabbinic Judaism during this period. The great academies of Sura, Pumbedita, and Nehardia flourished. This was the era when the Babylonian Talmud, a foundational text of Jewish law, ethics, and tradition, was compiled and redacted. An incredible intellectual achievement.
What was their status like under Sasanian rule? Was it difficult?
That's debated. Older scholarship often emphasized persecution. But more recent research suggests a more complex picture. While there were undoubtedly periods of tension and some hostile measures, for much of the time, Jewish communities seem to have enjoyed considerable internal autonomy, managing their own affairs. There's evidence of interaction, even cooperation, between Jewish leaders like the Exilarch and the Sasanian authorities. The sheer flourishing of Talmudic scholarship suggests this generally stable, if not always easy, environment was possible. And one more movement to mention is Mazdakism, which caused quite a stir under Kavad I.
Right. The sources described it as radical. What were its ideas?
It emerged from a Zoroastrian background, but had a strong social and ethical message that challenged the status quo. Mazdak preached a form of dualism, but emphasized communal ownership of resources, advocating for the redistribution of wealth, taking from the rich nobles. Sources also mention controversial ideas about sharing women, possibly a critique of aristocratic harems, and a call to break down social barriers. It promoted an ascetic lifestyle and criticized the hypocrisy of the clergy.
Sounds revolutionary. How did it play out?
It found significant support among the peasantry and others disaffected with the rigid hierarchy. Kavad initially seemed to support Mazdak, perhaps seeing it as a way to curb the power of the overweening nobles and clergy. This led to considerable social upheaval, but the backlash from the nobility and priesthood was fierce. They actually deposed Kavad for a time.
So the movement was crushed.
Eventually, yes. After Kavad regained his throne, with Hephthite help, remember, he turned against the Mazdakites. His successor, Khosrow III, brutally suppressed the movement in a massacre. But Mazdakism is significant because it highlights the deep social tensions within the empire and shows how religious ideas could fuel calls for radical social change. Some scholars argue Khosrow's later reforms were partly a response, an attempt to address some underlying grievances to prevent similar movements from arising again.
Okay, so we've seen the rise, the structure, the culture, the complex religious scene. Now let's turn to the end. After 4 centuries of power, how did the Sasanian Empire collapse? The sources suggest it wasn't just one thing.
No, definitely not. It was really a convergence of multiple factors building up over time. That internal instability we talked about, the powerful nobility, the succession struggles never really went away. Reform attempts helped, but didn't solve the fundamental problem of this decentralized power structure inherited partly from the Parthians. Actions by some later kings, like Hormizd the Fifth's harshness that led to Bahram Chobin's rebellion, or Khosrow II's reliance on Byzantine aid, which angered nobles, kept these tensions simmering. But the real knockout blow, the one that fatally weakened the empire, was that final, incredibly destructive war with the Byzantine Empire, the one from 602 to 628.
The one where Khosrow II initially conquered so much territory.
Exactly. He took Syria, Palestine, Egypt, pushed deep into Anatolia. The Sasanian Empire reached its absolute largest extent. It looked like total victory. But the Byzantine Emperor Heraclius managed this incredible comeback. He launched counteroffensives, won key battles like Nineveh in 627, and the Sasanians failed to take Constantinople.
What was the cost of that war?
Astronomical for both sides. Decades of intense fighting utterly exhausted the Sasanian state manpower, finances, resources. Everything was depleted. The sheer cost and eventual defeat led directly to Khosrow II being overthrown and murdered by his own commanders and nobles in 628.
So the war itself triggered internal collapse.
It was the catalyst. His successor, Kavad II, immediately sued for peace, gave back all the conquered lands, returned the True Cross relic, but the damage was done. The empire was broke, politically fragmented, and militarily spent. And then, right on top of that military and political disaster, came another catastrophe, the Plague of Shiro.
A plague. When?
Around 627, 628, hitting the western provinces, the heartland, particularly hard. It killed a huge portion of the population. Crucially, it also killed Emperor Kavad II himself just months after he took the throne.
Wow. So no chance for stability to return.
None at all. Kavad II's death plunged the already weakened empire into absolute chaos. His son was an infant, quickly killed. What followed was that period of intense civil war and rapid turnover of rulers. We mentioned generals, nobles, even the queens Boran and Azarmiduk, trying to hold things together. The administration was paralyzed. There was no chance to recover or regroup. The plague was a major factor in that final inability to resist. So you have this empire reeling, decades of exhausting war, internal political chaos, economic ruin, and then a devastating plague. It's into this perfect storm.
That the Arab conquest began.
Precisely. A new, unified, and highly motivated force emerges from the Arabian Peninsula, inspired by Islam. The sources note that the campaigns launched by the early caliph, starting shortly after the Prophet Muhammad's death in 632 CE, found the Sasanian state in this critically weakened condition, unable to mount effective, coordinated resistance. And that ultimately led to its downfall.
So, wrapping up our investigation here, we've journeyed from the Sasanian rise out of Parthian weakness. Seeing how they built this incredibly powerful empire, sophisticated military, complex society, a really vibrant culture that absorbed and passed on so much knowledge, and that intricate religious landscape. We've also traced those persistent internal struggles, the devastating impact of the long wars, especially the final one with Byzantium, and the final blows of plague and civil war that paved the way for the Arab conquests. Our goal was really to synthesize this complex history from the source materials you've been working with.
And hopefully this exploration has given you, the listener, a clearer, more insightful picture of the Sasanian Empire, its achievements, its complexities, and its really significant place in world history.
Absolutely. And maybe here's a final thought for you to ponder, something emerging from all this material. Given the convergence of factors we just discussed, the internal weaknesses, the exhaustion from decades of war, the crippling plague, the political chaos, was the Sasanian Empire's fall to the emerging Arab forces essentially inevitable by the 630s and 640s? Or can you pinpoint moments, perhaps different decisions or outcomes in that final war or the succession crisis that might have altered its fate? Something to think about.
Thank you for joining us for this exploration into the history of the Sasanian Empire.